Hi, Charisse here with a special announcement. You can now enjoy select episodes of Detailed in video form. That's right. Detailed is now available on RCAT's YouTube channel. Now, you may be thinking, I already listened to the podcast. No need to watch it on YouTube. Well, trust me, if you don't want to miss out, even if you're an avid listener of the podcast, the video format is a completely different experience. Not only is it like hanging out with us, but you also get to hear parts of the conversation that were left on the cutting room floor. You can also see the photos, drawings, and video as we discuss the incredible projects that are featured. Come join us on YouTube. Follow the link in our show notes, and let's get into the details. This is an original podcast by RCAT. Try the number one most used website for finding building product information and save time and money. No registration is required with RCAT, so try it today and get ahead on your next project. Visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com.
We brought in a lot of new plants, native plants and ground cover along the south and the west. We kind of bermed up on the west side, which is kind of nice, a little elevation to the ground plane as we go to the east side of the site, or sorry, west side of the site. And then SBC had these artists come in. I think SBC was involved too in the patterning for these fences that wrap around the site that support growth of native plants, kind of further surrounding the park and kind of intertwining the park and the building.
And a lot of the park and landscaping was sort of volunteer led. I think they worked with Dirt Core here in Seattle to do a lot of the planting and erecting of those fences. And so it was sort of one of the many components where volunteers were involved in actual kind of construction of the project.
This is Detailed, an original podcast by RCAT. I am your host, Charisse Lakeside, senior specification writer at RDH Building Science and fondly known as the CSI Kraken. We will speak with professionals who share their insights into the most complex, interesting, and odd building conditions and the ingenuity it took to make it work. Join me as I pull back the curtain on the building industry and uncover the lessons learned. You'll gain valuable knowledge to help you better navigate your next project. My guests today are John Gentry, AIA, and Amy O'Carroll, ARB, both co-founders of GOC, that's G-O apostrophe C, in Seattle, Washington. John previously worked as a project architect for 9 years in Seattle with a number of award-winning and internationally recognized practices. Growing up in rural North Carolina instilled a strong appreciation for the landscape and a passion for built structures. John believes that architecture born of a passionate process and inextricably tied to the act of making can inspire and elevate the everyday. Having designed custom lighting fixtures and furniture that have been exhibited and sold internationally, his work delves into architecture at every scale. Amy, born and educated in the United Kingdom at the University of Cambridge and the Architectural Association, moved to Seattle to pursue architectural practice with John Gentry after a successful transatlantic partnership in several design competitions. A one-year stint at Rural Studio, designing and building a house for $20,000 in rural Alabama, created a passion for hands-on experiences and problem-solving. Amy is passionate about design as a collaborative process and enjoys finding opportunities in this process that blur the conventional perceptions of what we understand as architecture. Founded in 2012, GOC has been widely published and recently awarded the AIA Emerging Firm of the Year in the Northwest and Pacific region. The project we will be talking about today is the Mini Mart City Park in the Georgetown neighborhood of Seattle, Washington. Don't let the name fool you. This project is not what you think. But before we get started, don't forget to take a look at the project photos and drawings as you listen along. You can click the link in our show notes or visit www.rcat.com/podcast. Nestled in Seattle's Georgetown neighborhood, Mini Mart City Park is not what it seems on the surface. What was once an abandoned gas station now serves as a vibrant cultural center thanks to the collaboration between GoSee and Sutton Barris Kohler, or SBC. The site and existing building had a storied history that amounted to a daunting task of revitalization.
The site is in Georgetown. Historically, that's always been a fairly industrial area of Seattle from kind of the 1930s with the lumber industry through to the arrival of Boeing. It's used during World War II. And it's meant that it's always been fairly contaminated and kind of saw a decline in the residential neighborhoods there and a lot of vacant buildings. And the project itself kind of, you know, is a means to revitalize a space in that area. And its siting is right between the kind of residential area and right on the border of Boeing Field. So it's sort of this physical boundary between industrial, residential, and also, you know, is very much in the middle of this quite highly contaminated brownfield area. So quite a challenging starting point for us to work with for the clients and owners when they kind of came across this site. The property itself kind of had many lives, from being a gas station in its original built form through to a laundromat, an office space. It had storage for Boeing for jet fuel underground. Mm-hmm. So it's had a varied life, but none of it being kind of conducive to a sort of healthy living environment for a space there. So that was kind of what we were working with in a, you know, real challenge versus other projects that we'd started on in the past.
The project goals were simple: to breathe new life into a neglected space, infusing it with art, culture, and education centered around the remediation of the site.
They had pretty clear goals. They had been working on the project for years before we even came on board. They kind of had these like title bullet points, like to cleaning the earth with art and architecture was one, to educate, to be a place to teach people about the remediation that was necessary for the site, and how we were kind of approaching that with the project. That was like an important initial goal. And then just the idea of these artists and us as the architects coming together, like art and architecture on this corner lot in Georgetown, to be like a permanent cultural center, a structure for people to come together and really strengthen community ties. And like, it's just been amazing to see it unfold in that way, mm-hmm. through the use of the community.
This project's evolution has been a journey that was years in the making, sparked by a serendipitous connection between SBC and GoSee. Their admiration for each other's work and a shared passion for addressing urban challenges laid the foundation for what was to come.
For us, for GoSee, I don't think we've ever been a part of a project that's been such a transformation from basically a complete blight on the urban residential landscape to the way it's being used now. Like if you walked by this site in 2008, it would be difficult to imagine how such a derelict structure and kind of overgrown site, like Amy mentioned, could become a hub for the community and also offer back public green space and be an ongoing educational tool for how the project can repair damaged land. So I mean, we really embraced that in the process. I mean, we couldn't believe our luck. Just to talk about Sutton Barris Kohler a little bit, 2000, probably 2003 or 2004, I'm in Seattle and I see an article in the local City Arts magazine. I think Sutton Barris Kohler had built a little island out on Lake Washington that they were like stranded on, you know, for a whole week. They kind of, so if these guys are doing like really interesting work, and like I kind of heard about them, almost 20 years ago. And so for them to come to us with a project that they were really passionate about, I mean, originally kind of presented it to us like the park and the building would eventually, and may still be the case, like be gifted back to the city, mm-hmm. in a way. So, yeah. That was just like amazing for us to kind of learn about. They came to us because they saw our floating sauna structure in, I think, the same magazine, in City Arts magazine. That's how they heard about us. So they kind of saw us as taking risk in the work that we were doing. We saw them doing the same and like wanting to do something different for the community. So we felt very fortunate to be asked to be a part of this project. Sutton Barris Kohler, SBC, had the same kind of vision when they approached the project. They wanted, mm-hmm. they kind of researched how many of these types of sites were in the Puget Sound region, and like, could this be kind of an inspiration for other people to take on this kind of project? I don't think they're going to be taking on one quite like this again anytime soon. But it, you know, for SBC, this was a project that started for them in 2005, and we were involved from 2014 to 2022. It was an ongoing process and took amazing dedication from their, you know, their team.
GOSI faced quite a challenge in restoring the site, which had fallen into disrepair.
What was left on the site was sort of the remnants of that original gas station building, which had been sort of heavily modified over the years and the different uses. But when we came to it, it had been derelict for a very long time, and you know, people had broken in. The site was overgrown with brambles and blackberries, and it was just this very inhospitable corner of this residential block. And we did, you know, have that initial hope that something could be salvaged. But as we started the design process, it really became evident pretty quickly that not only was the structure in really, really bad shape, but that 450 square foot wasn't going to be enough to really do all the things that needed to happen on the project and house all the program that the clients wanted. So we decided to demolish the building, but kind of keep the spirit of that kind of iconic idea of a gas station in the language of that architecture. You all kind of went through to the design process.
Recognizing the limitations of the old structure, plans were made for a new, larger building accompanied by a spacious park.
For the site, just kind of high level, it's on a corner lot facing east and south, which was kind of an advantage, you know, with so much of this kind of east-west site facing south. Like we knew we wanted, I mean, Amy mentioned the existing building wasn't big enough, but it was also centered right in the middle of the site. And so the new building, we really felt strongly that it should be like pushed as far north as we could, which we did. And we kind of set up a 1/3 building, 2/3 green space, like giving back as much kind of open green space around the building that we could. And most of that is kind of on that south part of the site. That was like a big driver early on just for like site planning. It turned out that we were able to use some of that north part of the lot, like on the north side of the building, for bioretention planters and a planted wall and a mural wall, that all stuff that kind of came in later. But really, the big site planning move was to have the building kind of pushed to the north. For the building itself, you know, it has this like linear quality to the building. So again, situated to the north, but then kind of stacking the program from east to west, like with this long sheltering roof that like ties everything together. This is like a design move that we love to embrace when we can on projects. Like, you know, and it kind of goes back to that first question about what's the bold move here. And that roof, like tying these spaces together from the front court on the east side of the site, the front court kind of being this kind of hearkening back to the old gas station where you'd pull up underneath to fill up, into the gallery space, which is kind of the central enclosed space on the site. The next sort of what we called like outdoor room was the courtyard between the gallery space up front and the utility kind of mechanical box in the back. So we really kind of set up this sort of chain of spaces, interior and exterior, along that east-west axis as the kind of like organizing design move for the building.
Central to the design was the creation of an open-air courtyard, a nexus where architecture and nature converge. Here, under the vast expanse of sky, residents would find solace in the greenery, a canvas for art installations, and a stage for communal events.
It's located in Georgetown neighborhood on a corner lot, kind of facing east towards Boeing Field, which is kind of interesting from a site location standpoint. The planes, I mean, it's a smaller airport than SeaTac, obviously, but the planes coming in are super low. Like, it's kind of that like really dramatic sort of landing spot as they fly over the building. So it's like you're in this sort of industrial zone of the city, but it's also surrounded by a little neighborhood area. Kind of, I guess, west of that arterial street where kind of public transit runs right alongside the building on the east side of the building. Like I mentioned before, the building sort of pushed to the north part of the site. We have this forecourt where like the roof cantilevers out to the east pretty dramatically, covering that forecourt area. We kind of imagine that to be not only like the big kind of announcing entrance to the building, but maybe a spot where like exterior dinners might happen. Mm-hmm. You know, there's lighting in the rafter kind of space up above, and just like a really inviting sort of entry that sort of announces itself to the east. And then those series of rooms. So the next space is like the main gallery and community space, community center space. All of the art kind of events, you know, happen in that main space. There's a linear skylight that's 15 foot long that runs the center of that spine of that space. It drops natural light down into the gallery. The next space over, as we're moving west across the site, we call it like an outdoor room, is the little courtyard. It's enclosed on the sides by the front gallery space and the utility box in the back, and then kind of a mural wall on the north side, and then opens itself up to the park to the south. And then the final little building volume is the utility box mechanical space. It's got two ADA bathrooms, and then of course it's got the air sparging system like within the mechanical space. So in that space, you're able to, John Sutton does a lot of the tours, and Ben Bears, recently, of folks that visit the site, but they definitely take people in there and kind of show off that system, you know, that it's a sustainable approach to dealing with a site like this. And we brought in a lot of new plants, native plants and ground cover along the south and the west. We kind of bermed up on the west side, which is kind of nice, a little elevation to the ground plane as we go to the east side of the site, or sorry, west side of the site. And then SBC had these artists come in. I think SBC was involved too, mm-hmm. in the patterning for these fences that wrap around the site that support growth of native plants, kind of further surrounding the park and kind of intertwining the park and the building.
And a lot of the park and landscaping was sort of volunteer led. I think they worked with Dirt Core here in Seattle to do a lot of the planting and erecting of those fences, and so mm-hmm. it was sort of one of the many components where volunteers were involved in actual kind of construction of the project. Mm-hmm.
The building itself pays tribute to its past, with design features reminiscent of old filling stations, including painted siding, a roof overhang, and divided metal windows.
You know, kind of early on in the design process and how we presented things in schematic design to Sutton Bears Color, we were wanting to kind of take cues from the original language of the gas station and that kind of iconic image everyone has in their head of the gas station forecourt, kind of like John mentioned, and really use it as a design tool to create these activated outdoor spaces. It was a budget-driven project too, so we weren't looking to use any sort of crazy materials that were going to be hard to maintain over the years, that we wanted something that could potentially be installed by volunteers if needed, easy to maintain. So we kind of returned to the idea of the, you know, traditional cedar painted siding, this sort of quite iconic language, bold language of the design, sign painting on the exterior mm-hmm. for the actual Mini Mart City Park logo, which you see a lot of that in Georgetown in the warehouse mm-hmm. and kind of auto mm-hmm. shop architecture and remnants of these old painted signs. So we really kind of drew inspiration from the history of the site and sort of used that to inspire us as to what this building could look like from the exterior and how it could be used spatially as well. The light blue on the underside of the forecourt kind of harks back to the traditional southern porches, both John's background in North Carolina, my time in Alabama, the idea of these blue ceilings, which were thought to ward off ghosts and spirits. We kind of presented that idea and the clients liked that too, being that we sort of did have this sort of semi-traditional language in some ways to the materiality of the project. So we kind of had these like fun little elements that you might not notice, but have, you know, some history to them.
Inside, the main gallery features unique design elements and flexibility. Exposed wood rafters and a skylight further infuse the space with warmth and character, while a discreet kitchen opens to the courtyard, blurring the lines between indoors and out.
Starting under those kind of exposed rafters and ceiling that's painted that kind of sky blue, you're on axis with this kind of east-west building. The entry door is right on axis with this 15-foot skylight. So you open the door, that skylight's running right down the spine of the building, dropping natural light through the rafters. The ceiling is all naturally kind of clear finished fir rafters and plywood. And over to the left, you would see this kinetic element, this big, I think it's 6'6" by 8 foot tall window, just kind of on the corner, the southeast corner of the space. And that was an effort for us. Like, we wanted to have lots of art walls surrounding the gallery for easily displaying work, but we really wanted a strong connection to that park element mm-hmm. to the south. And Amy and I kind of always called it the cafe corner, like where you could open this window up, kind of like the mechanic shop, like rolling yeah, the door yeah. back, you know, opening up to the outside. And we kind of imagined it. I'm not sure they've used it this way or not. Maybe they have, like, this little ticketing spot or beverages served to the park, and like really like a little gathering corner. As you move through the space, there's art walls either side. In the kind of northwest corner of that gallery room, there's a little kitchenette with open shelves and storage. And through the courtyard space, which has been amazing to see how they use this for, like, they've had DJs on the little bridge up above. They've had dance performances. They've had sculptures like in the courtyard space. We kind of saw this as this sort of multi-use exterior space, but also if they ever wanted to bring large pieces mm-hmm. of sculpture like through and into the building, the back sliders facing west, like, really stack open so that you can do that. And then the final kind of component, the volume to the west, is the, we call it the utility box. It's the mechanical rooms, the bathrooms, and kind of where that air sparging system is on display. And then a little mechanical roof access stair.
The featured kinetic window that John mentioned was brought to life in partnership with a local artist.
So we wanted this big kind of opening and connection to that South Park side. And it just so happened, like, if you walk through Georgetown, there's little kinetic sculptures kind of on the sidewalk down there next to some of the restaurants. And there's an artist named Chris McMullen. And this was like a previous relationship that Sutton Bears Color had yeah. with Chris McMullen. They knew of his work. They wanted to incorporate other artists into the build of the project. And so then we sort of just presented this idea, hey, there's a big window that, like, opens to the park here. We have some experience doing kinetic pieces. And then it was just natural. Like, they were like, well, we'll just have Chris make this piece. So, like, we gave him kind of overall dimensions, where we thought the pivot should be. And then Chris really, like, developed the whole, like, kinetic artistry of that piece. And it's kind of on display really, really thoughtfully yeah. kind yeah. of in the gallery. So it's just one of those moments that, you know, back to the original vision from the owners, like, bringing art and architecture together in this kind of cultural space. And that was a moment where we could do that.
Robust finishes were utilized to echo the industrial history of the area, rounded out by polished concrete with radiant heating and structural bridging.
So, kind of similarly to the exterior, the interior needed to be pretty hardworking as well. It was going to be have all these different uses, whether it was a gallery, having things, you know, hung on the walls over and over again, or community space, or a gathering space. It was just going to, you know, be used in many different ways, and needed to be able to respond to that and be easy for the owners to upkeep over the years. So the palette is pretty simple. There's simple white walls. There's plywood backing behind them so they can hang work over and over again and not, you know, mm-hmm. worry about the structural integrity of the drywall. Mm. Concrete, polished concrete floors with radiant heating as the primary heat source for the space. So they're very easy to clean. They can withstand, you know, the largest of sculptures being wheeled in that space. Someone can be working in there and not worry about, you know, damaging the floor or the finish. And then we have this kind of material warmth that comes from the ceiling, from the exposed fir ceilings and the exposed rafters. And again, kind of, we alluded to a little bit of that historic language with the structural bridging, which is kind of X bridging between the rafters, which you see in a lot of the old warehouse spaces around Seattle, mm-hmm. and wanting to kind of bring that language back into the project, so that, you know, it was another little area we were kind of touching upon the industrial history.
Mm-hmm.
the skylight drops in natural light really well into the space. So that was an important thing. We've got kind of windows on all sides to a degree, but having natural light for all the different kind of uses of the space was really important as well. But yeah, overall, just kind of making it very usable and durable and something that the owners and the users are going to be able to keep up with over the years, hopefully for a very long time with this project.
A central design challenge revolved around finding a spatial balance, ensuring sufficient room for the structure while maintaining the open park space as the focal point.
I think one of the challenging things was basically what we set up kind of in our design process. We sort of hemmed ourselves in a little bit, but I think it's a good thing by dedicating so much of that site to park, tightening up the kind of like linear quality of the building, locating it as far to the north as we could. I think we're right up against the setback on the north side. But it really did allow for the park to become kind of front and center. And then the building sort of accepts the park into the courtyard. It's sort of the space bleeds through, does the same thing to a certain extent on the forecourt side on the east. And then because we were set back a little bit on that north side, just based on city restrictions, like it allowed us to have a nice green wall, like planted green wall on that north side. There's the bioretention planters that all of the stormwater from the building go into on that north side. It really is the kind of utility sort of working side of the building. But initially we were like, okay, we've really pushed the building up, you know, as far north as we could. Now we got to lay out these spaces so that it still works. But luckily we had kind of the length of the site working east-west, and we were able to kind of create these interior and out and exterior rooms through the courtyard and the forecourt, kind of bookending the gallery space.
In many ways, Mini-Mart City Park is more than just a venue. It's a catalyst for positive change. Beneath its surface lies a remediation system silently working to cleanse the land of its past contaminants.
We weren't only dealing with the sort of the general brownfield nature of Georgetown and sort of this neighborhood in particular, but the particular uses that came from it being a gas station and the petroleum storage and even the laundromat, I think, probably added to that too. And this was always a real priority for the clients, that they create a healthy space for people to be in and an educational space. And they really saw it as a model to how brownfield sites like this could be used. And we learned a huge amount during the process. And they kind of started working pretty early on, even long before that we were involved in the project, with the Environmental Protection Agency as to how you could approach a site like this. And I think they, when they were talking about it to us, they sort of told us about these different approaches that you could take, where you either kind of isolate your property and do what you can to get rid of all that contaminated soil and kind of fill it back in and create almost like a physical boundary. I think they talked about like this lead bathtub approach for the site. And you're just sort of only dealing with that area, and they didn't really want to do that. There was a high cost to that, and they just didn't really see it as a sustainable approach to the problem. So working with, you know, different consultants, an environmental agency, they came up with the use of an air sparging system. So below the whole property, there's a series of sort of points where oxygen is introduced into the soil, and that oxygen activates the bacteria in the soil that eats away at the petroleum contaminants that are in the earth. So it's an ongoing process of remediation that even once that little area is cleared and clean, there's always going to be toxins driven into the property from the neighboring areas. So having a system which continually cleans forever, you know, in theory, as long as the structure's around, it was this like amazing sustainable approach to addressing the brownfield contaminated problem. And it's this great opportunity to educate the community about the area and the means and methods to which you can approach something like this. And they have, you know, groups of kids come through and kind of all sorts of other groups that they educate along the way to help them really understand what you can do with a project like this.
Apart from the innovative remediation system, the project includes a number of sustainability features.
Obviously, yeah, the remediation system is a huge part of the project. And it's already kind of, we did a little research with the analysis of what's been going on over the last few years, and it's already taken 97 pounds of petroleum contaminants out of the soil. So it's doing its job. But beyond that, we have a green roof up above the forecourt and also up above the gallery space. So that really helps with kind of stormwater runoff and just kind of slows down all our Seattle rain as it hits the roof. We always had a kind of future phase for solar as a future component for the project. They really want to aim for net zero on this building. So that is something that we're currently working on with the Minimart City Park team, is designing a solar canopy that's going to go over the courtyard, which will allow it to be kind of a really usable space year round. And it's also obviously going to be producing energy for the building. So that's pretty exciting that it's kind of like,
it's super exciting. I feel like a lot of projects say future solar, but this is one where they're actually, you know, just a few years later, we're now like working on permitting for this solar canopy. So it's really cool to see that going in going forward.
Yeah. And then just so they have some smaller elements, they were very cognizant of the types of plantings that were happening in the landscape and making those, you know, pollinator friendly and encouraging kind of the wildlife population to use the site too. So they've really been, sustainability has been sort of one of the driving forces from the beginning on the project.
The brownfield remediation effort was welcomed by the city of Seattle, who supported and assisted the team through the permitting process.
The permitting process was quite lengthy, and we were kind of lucky, like John said, SPC were just so dedicated to this cause, and particularly John Sutton, one of the artists and artist trio, kind of took this on as his sort of life work, almost did everything he could to make this happen. So there was a lot that happened behind the scenes before we were even involved. So they worked with the environmental agencies and with the city for quite a few years. Well, I guess from 2008, when they actually bought the property, till when we started in 2014. So they had done a lot of the legwork and had some great support from people in the city. A lot of grants kind of already lined up as well for culture and neighborhood matching funds, and just had sort of really laid the groundwork for us. So when we came along, we weren't dealing with too much to do with sort of environmental restrictions. And it was more, I guess, typical kind of architectural permitting problems that we had, you know, a change of use for this, you know, the zoning of this site. It's technically classified as an institution, and the city has these rules that you can't have two institutions within, I think, 400 feet, and there's a church around the corner. So we had to do a master use permit. So there was a lengthy master use permit process just to be allowed to have this type of building on this piece of land, and then sort of the more typical building permit, you know, challenges. So it took a number of years, as did everything with this project, but it worked out. And being that it was an entirely grant funded project, the timeline, you know, sometimes you can't really look at it in the same way as a typical project. And that lengthy permitting time kind of gave them more time to, you know, gather the funds so that we would be in a better spot once we did get everything approved to actually start building this. So we learned a lot through the process, and just kind of seeing the support from the city for a project like this really kind of gave us hope that it would all come through in the end, and it did. So it was great.
During construction, unpredictable grant timing challenged project sequencing and scheduling.
The main challenge on this one was just sort of how atypical the timeline was for the project. We had to really think about phasing of the construction as it aligned with grants coming in and certain grants that had to be used associated with certain phases of construction. So that was a big conversation between us and the contractor and the owners from the beginning, is that, okay, we have to, like, I think the first phase, you know, of foundations was tied to a certain grant, and then we had to kind of pause because we were waiting for other money to come in, which was going to be associated with different things. And so sometimes sort of the phasing and the timing wasn't sequential even necessarily. Some things had to get done a little differently just because of how closely they were tied to the fundraising of the project. So that was definitely something we had not come across before, and was a little challenging at times. And there was a lot of stops and starts in the project, which can be a little disheartening when you're not, you know, getting the usual construction momentum and you want to see a project kind of come to life. But it was just the nature of how the whole project was funded. And
being ready for that in the process and flexible about timing when we start back work.
Yeah. But we had a great team and everyone involved, like, you know, kind of like we've all been saying, was so passionate about the project that they really wanted to get it done and mm-hmm. done right. And that was a really good experience.
Projects of this nature that endure lengthy timelines require patience and optimism, which is paramount to reach the finish line.
I think, like, it's important for this project, especially this going out to lots of people, if they're listening into this podcast, is like to understand the dedication it took, especially, I would say, on the owner side, in this case, three artists that, you know, in total worked on the project for 17 years, up from 2005 to...
And are still involved.
22. They're still involved.
In the programming of the building.
And we've mentioned the funding, you know, for the construction, but they were grant funding for all of the programming for the first 5 years of the building. So, like, to have, like, that kind of long view, we said this a bunch in the process, like, I always think of the work of Christo and Jean-Claude and, like, the timelines that they work on for realizing projects that had to go through lots of hoops with wherever they were in the landscape. If you're familiar with their work, I mean, they would start ideas for projects and then complete them 30 years later. Like, I mean, yeah. Sutton Bear's Color, like, we're committed in that way. And I think we took that from this, like, jumping on board is probably not a lesson learned just on this project, but we try to remind ourselves when projects come in that seem challenging, maybe we don't know, like, the owner's total vision. I think with Sutton Bear's Color, they were very clear.
Yeah.
But a lot of times, like, maybe the vision isn't as clear, but you still have to be optimistic from the beginning because it may all come to fruition. So you want it to, like, be successful in the end. So, like, having that, like, optimistic view but just to return to, like, just understanding what it takes to do a project like this was incredible from the owner and artist side. And a big lesson for us, it was just inspirational to see them at mm-hmm. every corner, like going back to grant funding, going back to volunteers, asking other donors to help out. Like, I mean, yeah, that's a lesson we'll take to a lot of projects, I think.
Yeah, we were constantly astounded by mm-hmm. their drive and resilience on a project like this. And
we've had a couple of other owners in the same way that we've just been surprised at every turn. So,
yeah,
it's cool.
Yeah, so I think, just kind of adding on to what John said, having that patience for a project like this and then, like, the trust in these really passionate clients that as a team we can make it happen, even if...
And we were too. I mean, we started GoSee in late 2012. We heard about this project after doing a few built things in those first 2 years. We heard about it in 2014. So we jumped on and did an initial schematic design phase pro bono so that they could just have the renderings of the project so that they could fund it. So, like, we were all in from the beginning too, knowing that the funding was going to be a challenge. So it took everyone. The contractors were amazing that finished the project. Like, those guys did an amazing job translating the drawings and following all the details through.
Arguably, the most remarkable aspect of Mini Mart City Park is its capacity to host a diverse array of events, community outreach initiatives, workshops, and art exhibitions. John and Amy are quick to note what a joy it was to work on a project like this one.
I think now it is, seeing it come to life and just seeing the amount of diverse activities that happen in there, whether it's, you know, kind of what we first initially thought, these, like, exhibits from different artists, but they have workshops there, they have potlucks, they have movies in the park, they have bands come and play. Obviously, they've got, you know, community involved activities, you know, community meetings and the like. But it's just amazing to see it sort of reimagined by each person that's using it. You know, we've seen, like, dance groups come and do, like, site specific performances. Artists take over in different ways. It's just really exciting mm-hmm. to see what people do differently with both the building and the park itself, like, and how they both work together to kind of create these special experiences for the community and visitors. So that's, it's just really fun to see everything that's happening there and see their programming for the next few years. And I think I think they're like booked out for years, you know, ahead with different artists and exhibits and events going on. So that's really fun to see.
I would also say that I don't want to make John Sutton, Ben Bears and Zach Culler's heads too big, but I had followed their work for years, and to be able to work in collaboration as architects with artists that we love and admired, and that we're doing, they do, I mean, you have to check out their website. They do weird projects that are just like out there, risk-taking, inspiring, and like, yeah, and then this project comes along, we get to work together on something. It was amazing. Like, that's probably my favorite thing about it.
Yeah, it was definitely sort of a dream type of project for us when it came along, especially so early in our kind of formation as a business.
MiniMart City Park presents a possibility of urban spaces that are repurposed for the greater good. By turning a problem into an opportunity for education and improvement, it demonstrates the transformative power of art and architecture, inspiring hope for a brighter tomorrow. Before we close out this episode, I always try to gain some additional insight from our guests about the greater industry. The MiniMart City Parks journey got me thinking about how many of these derelict buildings and sites are out there in the world. How can we view these sites through a different lens?
Forgotten or overlooked buildings or spaces or sites, they sort of, you know, force you to create the most creative responses, and the challenges kind of lead to opportunity in a way. So if you're up for the challenge, you can really, you know, create something unique and make a big impact on the surrounding community. You know, something that might have been seen as abandoned or derelict or just, you know, a blight to the neighborhood can be transformed into something, you know, really wonderful if you have the right approach to it and the right passion and drive, because it takes longer and is harder, but you know, you need the architects and the clients and the builders who are willing to face those challenges head on and kind of see the future, see what might be there and create something amazing. So in a way, it's an opportunity if you look at it the right way.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Amy and John. I hope this episode sparks a new idea, helps you solve a problem that you've been working through, or inspires a mark that you want to leave on this world.
So Amy and I have spent some considerable time over the last year thinking about this type of question. And we believe it's a very important one. Important enough, I think we included a section on our website. We kind of added to our profile narrative. But like our professional mission is, as a practice, is to cultivate a collaborative design ethos dedicated to producing expressive and contextual architecture that enriches its place. And I mean, MiniMart City Park is a great example of this, how it brings people together, how we can do that better, like in our design process. Like, we talk a lot about just being open to all possibilities, you know, questions arise about what the right solution is. Like, the answers to those could come from any number of places and any number of people on the team. And that goes to everyone in our office. Just remaining open in that process. We aim to be, we try to be, I think we are doing that. And I feel like this project is an example of that.
I think kind of what John said, you know, creating architecture that enriches its place. Like, I think that's probably one of the most important things. And we really hope that our responses to these challenges and sites and locations and landscapes result in a building that is enriching and kind of going all the way back to the beginning, creating that shelter for the soul, you know? I think that's sort of the most that we can hope to do.
Yeah. And on a personal note, I mean, what better type of project to be a part of, having a 1-year-old now, and you know, leaving this world in a better place, and having a project that's like taking some risks, trying to do something bold within the community that's gonna hopefully be around and used for many years to come. And Amy kind of mentioned this earlier, but just how inspiring it's been to see it used in so many different ways that we didn't plan for. is really exciting.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, visit rcat.com/podcast to see photos, details, and more related project and product information that we discussed today. While you're there, take a look around rcat.com. For over 30 years, RCAT has been the resource for AEC professionals to find the right products for their project. Try RCAT and see how their tools can save you time and money and help you get ahead on your next project. Visit rcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can support us by subscribing, leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and sharing this with your friends. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back to share more stories and lessons learned to help you navigate your next project.